For 2 days I had the pleasure of wandering through public and private libraries, museums and English clubs, churches, shops, supermarkets, up and down the famous Calle de la Unión. As we could not speak to each other while in public, we appraised everything by the touch of our hands or little gestures. Because of the wonderful physical and mental well-being after days and weeks of pain, I look upon this short time I spent with Siti as the happiest couple of days in my entire life. A period of convalescence. Perhaps this was all due to the life-saving tablets she had given me. If I come to think of it, my mental clairvoyance during these days was simply extraordinary. It was the first time that I understood that the way these people feel about time. I really understood how they feel about life. You see, we human beings think of life as a period where we have to hurry things. To our friends from outer space, this looks as if we are afraid of life itself. As if life was the worst part of our destiny, as if it were a great misfortune. Of course, as so many people still suffer on our planet, how can this be considered otherwise? But being with Siti, I suddenly began to see things their way, relaxed. They are, and perhaps more than relaxed, they are just infallibly considerate to everything. Siti's interest, for instance, in music was something wonderful to experience. At the entrance of the Calle de la Unión in Lima, there is a record shop. Already passing the Hotel Bolivar on the Plaza de San Martin, Siti acoustic nerves had taken up the rhythm of this shop's loudspeaker playing some Colombian cumbias. She really liked that, and there is reason to suppose that it would have been no better, or say cultured, if she had listened to Beethoven instead. She simply liked the rhythm of cumbia. Seldom have I seen a happier look on someone's face as this strange woman passed the record store. How many people on our earth, I thought, are able to enjoy forces of rhythm as much as Siti did? At the time in Lima, I did not know that I would soon be able to experience the great sensitive activities of these people, that I would hear about their work, their beneficial and health-restoring religion, their very life and death. The highly abnormal circumstances into which I was drawn were never exhausting. As a matter of fact, they were agreeable to my health. I simply liked to be with Siti, and when she asked me if I would want to meet her brother, I was very pleased to accept her invitation. Then a footnote of this on page 106. Footnote: one of our most enjoyable pleasure was offering several beautifully carved gold ingots, which Siti asked me to exchange for the local currency. This rare and rather novel method of converting into local currency took place on the second floor of one of the old Spanish style commercial houses in Union Street in Lima. Even though Cuito, a few adventurers and not too well dressed Indian natives are still trading in gold, like in the old Western times in Bolivia, Ecuador and Peru, the beautifully melted and calmed ignorance surprised the specialists. That was the footnote. Next page is then chapter 6. It is has titled Through the Front Door of Hell. On the 17th of February 1967, the week of the summer zenith of the Peruvian year, we left Lima at 7:45. Loaded with packages and suitcases, crammed full of books, records, seeds, and God knows what else that city had bought, our train journey was to take us over the highest railroad pass which has ever been constructed, thousands of feet up the majestic Andes Mountains, from the streaming hot coastal plains of Peru. The train was to take us through the River of Evil Valleys, as the Indians call it, to the very front door of Amazonic Hell, Yancayo, surrounded by snow-covered hills, the last outpost of demi-civilized wilderness. The train pulled out of Central Station right on the button. We had 2 first-class windows, seats to ourselves. The green livery of the train made a splendid splash of color as the engine headed its way toward the high mountains. Of course, the ubiquitous British had built this railway. Wherever you go in the world, in the most unlikely and inaccessible places, you are almost sure to come across a British-built railway. They must have had a mania in building railways, as their own small island did not give them much scope for laying out roads on a grand scale. They moved into other territories either by conquest or by invitation and built their railways. Magnificently, I doubt if any other people expect that perhaps the Americans could have built a line to compare with those that worn their way up to the Andean roof of the world. Naturally, the British expect to benefit from all this railway building. Passenger traffic alone will not be much of a recompense. Here in the Andes, as the other places where the British have left their mark, the hills, the mountains are bulging with mineral wealth waiting to be mined and shifted to the industrial powers of the world. In the particular case of the Andes, the mineral is chiefly copper. The journey is most thrilling, even for the most hardened of travelers. It is not a fast run, for the line is so tortuous. Seat and I were happy to watch the scenic splendor of the trip up the high mountains. The River Rimac is the first major hazard out of Lima. Frail bridges take the line over the curving river, which races crazily far below. The railway then treads its way through steep canyons, pierced by hundreds of mephitic tunnels, beyond each of which is another breathtaking view. Nearer and nearer chugs the train to the cruel peaks of Oruro Mountains. Round about 11, we pulled into Matucana. Even before the train had stopped, the carriages were besieged by hundreds of pitiful barefoot sellers of corn cob, tortillas, and soft drinks who importuned the passengers, as did the countless children who came shouting, pushing and poking their way through the cellars and beggars. Innumerable dogs who also came to see what they could scavenge from the train. Matukana is the last stop before the train enters the towering highland region. It is also the last stop where tropical fruit can be bought, and the last place to see happy faces. Thereafter, life in the Andean highlands is grim and earnest. The line climbed for another 5,000 feet, and the train clicked its way into the sky. We were now in the land of the stoical, melancholic, and ever distrustful Indians. This is the land where the Spanish conqueror Francisco Pizarro went out of his mind. The land is cold, wild, and windy. The barren terrain stretches endlessly. The few towns in the area, La Union, Junin, and Huancayo, are unfriendly and pathetic. We had booked two tickets to Huancayo, where Sol City informed me Satura would be waiting with transport. I did not ask how she had communicated with her brother. I take it for granted that if they wanted to do something, they would do it, even though an ordinary mortal such as myself might have difficulty in accomplishing what was to be done. Shortly after 4 o'clock that afternoon, we arrived at Huancayo. I found it to be a fair-sized Indian mountain town, around about the 13,000 foot contour. The roads are often impassable because of snow or a sudden cloud burst. Surrounding narrow canyons, the steep peaks of the Andes, dilapidated mud huts, gyne, cacti, all these give the place an almost surrealistic air. The marvel is that the railway could reach this spot. At the station we were met by Mr. Satura, whom I did not recognize at first. He was dressed very much like the natives, with heavy woolen gear. There wasn't much difference to be noticed between his looks and the taxi driver who he had charged with helping to unload all the luggage. We had a brief word of greeting, and then we busied ourselves pushing all the impediments Siti had discovered in the Peruvian capital into the car. Never in all my life have I seen such a vehicle. No fenders, and with broken back window. The old Buick also had no hood, and the motor could be observed in full operational vigor. We were much amused by this, and as soon as we were on the road, the old Buick surprised us with one of the finest radios to which I have ever listened. Soon after leaving Huancayo, we passed some Inca ruins. These were the first I had ever seen, and Satura kindly stopped the car in order that we might take a closer look at the ruins. The Incas, as we have all learned, have left many well-preserved settlements. At this particular site there were also ruins of a fortress. Satura had evidently visited this before, and he told me some interesting facts about it, and also showed me the secret entrance to what must have been the royal treasure chamber. Night comes early in the Peruvian mountains, so we could not stay too long exploring the ruins. We had to carry on with our drive. Just as dusk was falling, we came to a trail that led down to a huge lake. It might have been part of Lake Junin or some other of the many lagos del Altiplano that litter the way to La Union. As soon as we stopped and unloaded the car, the taxi driver said adios and wanted to kiss the hands of Mr. Satura, something absolutely out of the question in Peru. It surprised me very much, and I believe that Satura must have helped this man or some sick member of his family. I was never told, nor have I ever seen this man again. After we saw his unfortunate vehicle disappear, we enjoyed the very peaceful lake side, with the snow-covered Andes peaks in the background. We observed the setting sun coloring the white of the mountain with pure gold. A great feeling of happiness came over me. There was also an Indian shepherd with many beautiful big and fat sheep. Instead of being fascinated by the sunset, he was fascinated by us. I shall never forget this shepherd. Thinking about it today, I still have to laugh. You see, the very moment the sun had disappeared, I saw my first flying saucer, and at the same time as it settled down gracefully and easily on the surface of the lake, I saw the shepherd disappear with the speed of a hunted rabbit. In spite of my being filled with a terrific sensation of awe, I just could not help laughing at the Indian's dashing velocity. There was a soft but painful noise, or rather reverberation, as the saucer glided towards the edge of the lake, right to the spot where we were waiting. It was then when I thought I could not bear it any longer, and that the whole valley with its lakes and hills would be ripped to pieces. As the noise disappeared, a few decibels from painful to bearable, the saucer hovered and opened up underneath its circular surface. Like a giant crooking his little finger, an embarkation device, soft and gripping at the same time, scooped us up and deposited us in some kind of antiseptic reception quarter. Immediately I became aware of the biological vegetational cellular structure similar to soft polyurethane embellished with exquisite designs and symbols. Only the floor was a little harder, and I suppose the reason for this must be its mirror-like quality. Through this floor you could see as surgeon would be able to see your brain. You could see a billion nerves and blood vessels. It was like looking into the living cells of a giant overdeveloped brain. right there and with cities attending. I was stripped to the buff. Imagine to take a bath. We are down on page 111 and the footnote says, so much has been written and talked about the subject of flying objects, and a great deal of money has been spent by various military and private research investigators, but despite all this, when you actually see a flying saucer for the first time, I believe that not one in a million scientific investigators would be able to explain the fantastic feeling that I experienced. I certainly do understand the shepherd's fear, and I probably would have dashed off at the same speed if I had not known that this would happen eventually. Well, that was end of chapter 6, and next is chapter 7. It is called The Slave Planet, chapter 7. My first trip in a flying saucer reminded me of the first trip I made to made by Comet, so a Comet aeroplane, I suppose, from New York to London on the Boak route. I had come from New Jersey to Idlewild, the airport for New York, where I was to switch to the Boak Comet. That's an airplane, I suppose. Idlewild has now been renamed Kennedy Airport, but by whatever name it is called, it took me as long to get from New Jersey to New York and across that airport as it took for the Comet to whisk me across the Atlantic to London. Of course, the difference of speed of the two parts of the journey cannot be compared to the speed between the Comet and the flying saucer, simply because the flying saucer do not fly, nor are we able to feel speed. There was nothing mysterious about the actual flight. I felt completely safe and relaxed. As a matter of fact, I did not even know how long the flight had lasted. Inside the craft there was a discreet hum, the rhythm like the sound associated with a low voltage waves or with turbines, as I thought then. Evidently the reverberations I had heard and felt when I first observed the flying saucer settle were either linked with particular maneuvers or were merely externalized noise. During the bath, I remember, I suddenly felt sleepy and I must have lost consciousness. When I woke up, I found myself in some very comfortable, soft sleeping device, suspended like a hammock, but at the same time attached to many hundreds of fine and multicolored veins and vessels. This, I later was told, is part of a medical computer system, parenthesis health analysis during sleep, forming only a small part of life preserving treatments, end of parenthesis. Go on. CT, who had obviously risen earlier or not slept at all, had brought to me a very kimono-like garment and answered my first questions. There was so much I wanted to know that she hardly knew where to begin. Then I was invited to the most controversial breakfast of my entire existence. Instead of toast, eggs and bacon, I found the gelatinous looking plant from their planet impossible to eat, and I tried to try the complicated arrangement of small containers from which I was supposed to sip. I was curious about the contents of these gadgets, so I started to take a sip of random. They all had a wonderful time just laughing like little children about my lousy behavior. The wife of one of the so-called astronauts showed me how to do it. Nevertheless, I left practically with an empty stomach. Perhaps the most sensational thing about the spacecraft was the fact that there were no locks and doors, no keys, no particular private or separated quarters, not even rooms. Everything, and even the commanding cell called the Yano or the I, was part of the biological structure of the craft. There was not one straight line, so to speak, in the whole spacecraft, nor were the circular forms exactly circular. At all times, the A of the craft is part of this body. The center unit of the craft was geared with other instruments that its power of involvement was complete. In other words, the A center unit is some kind of activated memory, a transmitting and receiving center similar to our brains. The amazing thing is that I was able to experience later how the individual brain of the saucer became part of the great giant system of cosmic generator brains, and in particular how this great individual unit had to be considered a minute part of a great memory computer on the home planet itself. The Itiberians, far from hiding anything from me, encouraged my curiosity. At all times I was asked about my impressions, which I gave voluntarily and with exactness. The impressions of a meat-eating animal, the impressions we would want to know from the Neanderthal type man about our skyscrapers. During the first day that I stopped at my observation post, the A-room was focused for long periods of time on the home planet Itiberia 2. Satura kindly arranged this in order that I might be acquaint myself with the kind of life that the Itiberians lived when they were not exploring the universe in their flying saucers. So it was that I saw their methods of transportation, their food processing installations, their biological machinery, and their instruments. I even listened to a concert and invaded some of the homes. I use the word invaded deliberately, because the involvement brought about by the I, so-called I, makes one feel as if one was actually going to these places, going to the concert, for example, or visiting friends in their own home. One thing I soon became convinced: Satura and Siti were not exaggerating when they said that their people were happy people. I saw evidence of this happiness. Not once did I notice anybody who might have been said to look fearful, unhappy, and sad. I liked their domestic architecture and layout. Most of their homes were built along rivers banks and the sides of lakes and other waterways. Their architecture was unlike any I had seen on Earth, except in futuristic exhibitions. They delighted in dominant colors, a vivid orange being particularly favored. If I were asked to give one outstanding characteristic of the Tiberians, I observed through the egg generator, I would again come back to their happiness. Everybody seemed to be smiling, young and old. There didn't appear to be many unhealthy people about, but the generator was trained on to what they call health centers, and I saw that even patients there were smiling. Smiling certainly seemed to have a therapeutic effect on these people. Linked with the all-pervading air of happiness on Itibira 2 was an atmosphere of calmness and serenity. No one seemed out of patience. Nobody appeared to be in a hurry. Nobody seemed angered or disgusted. I was so engrossed in what I was living through, for this is the best way to describe how I spent my first day inside the flying saucer, that I could not absorb all the detail of what I saw and heard. Later on, in the quietness of what they call the health center of the craft, I was able to collect my thoughts, go over my recollections and make some proper notes in the diary that I kept, using mostly shorthand. What intrigued me most about Itibira 2 was the fact that it was fused with two very small satellite planets. This, Satura explained, when I tackled him about it, was a quasar unit with a giant heart. The larger planet was, of course, Itibira 2, which I had been observing so closely all day. The third slave planet, so-called slave planet, was a much smaller biological body and merely called the factory. The heart planet functioned as an enormous artificial heart, pumping power into the fused planet. The Tiberian engineers had got at the power of the factory by slicing the top of it, rather as if they had sliced off the top of a giant egg. The factory thus became a power mine whose enormous and virtually everlasting energy they were able to tap at will. A long time ago, I was informed, the higher civilizations in cosmos came to the conclusion that all cellular forms of life are sensitive and susceptible to cancer. Because of technical improvement, they say, humanity shall not live longer but shorter. Because of the self-created artificial life in it is extremely easy to die, and it is our own desire for comfortable substitutes and artificial conditions which bring us closer to death. But not only human beings are infested with cancer-producing conditions. These cancer, so-called cancer planets, as our friends call them, have fallen to the habit of their surroundings. Because of the permissive age, they have not had the courage to and foresight the Itibirians had to separate all artificial and mechanical working machinery and all the research from their normal surroundings. All the dirty work, if the reader excuses this expression, these wonderful people have learned to do automatically and under perfect mechanical conditions on the separately attached so-called slave planet. Of course, the word slave planet is not the correct interpretation, for the Itabirayan's word Koksa Siiksiksan, which means planet factory. Through the A-generator, I was able to peer right into the bowels of this factory planet. To me, it looked for all the world like an opened-up octopus. This vast number of tentacles were, I suppose, the channels and cable tapping the power sources. Not the flying saucers, but this slave planet power concept I consider a main achievement of the people from space. It was from the factory that my friends had boundless energy for any purpose they required, for cosmic transportation, production, research and climatic conditioning. Because of these vast and endless supplies of energy taken from nature itself, they were no longer bothered by earthquakes, floods, hurricanes, thunderstorms and other similar disasters. With this power at their command, they could neutralize the capricious forces of nature itself. Siti had made no idle boast when she had said that they could change their environment. This was the very thing that they had done, and they had done it without danger to health. Towards evening, Satura and some of his colleagues, who all appeared to be knowledgeable scientists, came to the A-generator and sat beside Siti and myself. I spoke in awe at the ingenuity that had been shown by the Tiberians in harnessing this massive force. Satura smiled quietly. He loved to use the variety of his language computer to talk, preferably in French. This is one of his favorite answers, which I noted in my diary. Zest your minds, gombligo. They are French, I cannot read, so I only hope it comes a translation. As a matter of fact, their remarkable achievement are proof of this saying, and the saying I could not interpret, as it was French. They have been able to regulate their own sense system for the best possible intercosmic time sequences. They have invented what they call Akai, the biological heart planet. The working units with the low pumping noise, the accurate operating of the giant pulsars or newly formed balancing planets. They apparently even brought certain changes within their galaxy. That was done on page 117, and I end this part of the book here, and it goes on to next in a separate audio file.